This is Black Guy, White Guy Talking. I'm a black guy. I'm Elwin.
I'm a white guy. I'm Zach.
And we became friends by talking. Talking about race and race relations. This episode was recorded on July 8th, 2021. Tonight is a very special night. I have a very good friend of mine, Mr. Gabriel Bryant. He's a Philadelphia-based organizer, activist, educator, and behavioral health specialist whose passion is to build community leadership and support the development of black men and boys. He works with several organizations, including membership in the Black Philly Radical Collective, Philly Jericho Network, and supports the campaigns to free political prisoners, including Mumia Abu-Jamal, Russell Maroon Chouettes, and previously the Move 9. Gabriel is also a hip-hop artist and enjoys traveling. He has been a featured speaker and lecturer at many colleges and universities across the country and provides several trainings and workshops focusing on the impact that we can make to imagine a radical new future. In addition, Mr. Bryant's latest creation is a film called We Breathe, We Live, Brotherly Love Protest Stories. It presents the first-person experiences of seven different men of color from a variety of backgrounds who participated in the George Floyd-inspired Black Lives Matter protests that occurred in Philadelphia during the summer of 2020. The powerful emotional stories are woven together with conversations about race, trauma, and healing. Mr. Gabriel Bryant, welcome, who is also the unofficial mayor of the city of Philadelphia. How you doing,
brother? It's a pleasure and an honor and a privilege to be on this particular podcast and be in conversation with y'all. And you all are doing something special. And so I just applaud you all for your ongoing work in this field. So thank you.
I appreciate that. I just want to give a little bit of background because, you know, we know each other very well. And, you know, we have mutual respect for each other.
No question.
I consider you a brother of mine.
Likewise.
You know, I just have to say, before we get into, you know, our conversation, you are a person who I feel the work that you do it so selflessly. Since I've known you, I've known that you've just always been a stand-up, solid individual. But beyond that is your humility. You have time for everybody. I've never seen you push anybody to the side or say no. You never try to absorb any type of spotlight. You are just a solid individual through and through. And I just think people who know you know that, but you don't sing that for yourself, and I want to sing it for you. And I want to make sure that it's
known. I appreciate you, bro.
Absolutely. And I'm not going to keep going because I know you, you know what I mean? I know how you roll, but you know what I mean? I just have to let that be known, okay?
Yeah. No, I appreciate that, bro.
Before we start, I want to jump into, as we talked earlier, you texted me before, you were coming from a community organized meeting that was based around the shooting that just occurred in Southwest Philadelphia over the past weekend.
Yes, sir.
I think there were two young black men were killed, one injured, over 100 of 100 shots fired.
Unbelievable.
I think it was in the nighttime, but I think the young brother had a clothing store, and he was young. He's 23 years old. I don't know if he was a father.
But he was.
He was a father. When I heard about it, I was shocked. My heart sunk. It's too much of an ongoing story. You know, this is something that you are always on the front line. Can you speak about that a little bit?
We're dealing with a lot of heavy community devastation right now. Despair, hopelessness, helplessness. You know, the sad part is not only were we preparing for that event from the weekend, but if you didn't see the news last night at 55th and Race, somebody let off 50 shots.
Jeez.
There was a shootout at 55th and Race last night. So we had to literally deal with both situations tonight. What we did was we tried to bring together both folks from 60th Street, and we invited some of the neighbors down 55th Street because it wasn't too far away. But the bottom line is, you know, Elwin, man, we got a lot of work to do, man. You know, there's a lot of challenges that black folks, brown folks are dealing with. We're talking about challenges of poverty, challenges of trauma as a result of COVID-19, you know, unemployment, you know, brothers that may not have had jobs. But even prior to that, even if they had jobs, I mean, we're talking about a clientele, a demographic of people who just have, frankly, feel like they have nothing to lose. You know, they feel like they have nothing to lose. And, you know, I was telling the brother today, it's like when I was young in the game, the most that you might have had, like the big high level weapons on the block for us, I remember was like a Tech 9, like a Mac 10.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that was the era. Whoever saw, you know, Boys in the Hood, you know, the scene where the brother bumps Ricky when they're outside and then he shoots up in the air.
Up in the air, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that was like the main big thing. Yeah. But now, 20 years, 30 years later, I've met and engaged with 15-year-olds who know how to operate an AR-15, AK-47, all kinds of weaponry that's military grade. To load up for over 100 shots, man, I mean, you're dealing with some serious weaponry, bro. And to feel like it's so willy-nilly, you're not even afraid that two teenage girls are going to get shot in the process. Like, you're not even worried. Like, that's not even a concern of yours. So, yeah, man, we need more support from communities. I don't want to give up, but I understand why some of our neighborhoods have told me, like they told me tonight, Brother Gabe, I've just given up because this problem is too big for any of us to manage at this point.
Right. Yeah. I guess it was just 4 days ago on July 4th, 20 people got shot in a 25-hour window. And then right here in the neighborhood where we are, not 22 hours ago, somebody just...
I don't understand. Like, I was in a barbershop and I really didn't even know the full story. I was in a barbershop and obviously, you know, when you go to barbershop, you hear a lot of things.
Everybody's talking, right?
Everybody's talking. And then, you know, he has TV on. We start putting on the YouTube videos. And I start thinking, I thought to myself, the way it happened, they said that, because I start thinking that there's a lot of people they invited to this party outside. But it's like, how did he specifically get hit?
This is what I'm saying.
But I told them when I was in the shop, I said they had to have lasers. They had to have like infrared lasers. So we watched a couple of videos and they was like, I don't know about that. I watched another coverage of the show and they showed that the guys that were shooting had lasers or like infrared lasers on.
That's crazy.
On their guns. Because when you watch it, you see a whole bunch of people running down the block, right?
Yeah, they're scattering, yeah.
They're scattering. But all of those bullets goes off, two people get hit, right? The guy that was an intended hit, when it got confirmed that they actually had the infrared beams or the lasers on their guns, that's when I said, this is just really out of control. Out of control. I don't know if I feel hopeless. I'm starting to feel numb, though. Like, I'm starting to feel a sense of numbness, like it's like you almost like a doctor that's done 1,000 surgeries.
Right.
He's used to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're becoming used to this kind of violence.
Desensitized.
And that's what I don't like that.
No, I don't either. And these are our mass shootings. Like we talk about, you know, like a mass shooting deaths that might go on in middle America.
Right.
Nah, urban America has mass shootings.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And we have to really understand that for what it is. You know, there's multiple folks being taken out all at one time. And you have whole neighborhoods now, whole blocks that are traumatized by what they experienced. And many of them, unfortunately, won't have any type of grief counseling or, you know, mental health process to cope with what they experienced that night.
Right.
You know, and that's the piece that we don't talk about enough either. You know, 100 shots to hear that.
100 over.
Picture over 100 shots. But then also now, also, what have we heard in our neighborhoods? These loud firecrackers you know, for the past 3 weeks. So now you couple that with you experience those 100 over 100 shots. Then you got firecrackers at night. Everything's triggering. It's too much.
Too many guns in the street.
So when you bring that up, it brings me to a question comes in my mind. You know, throughout our culture and in the history of our culture, we've had, you know, various leaders show up, right? You know, I consider you to be a leader, but a different kind of leader. You're not the typical leader. You move in a different kind of way. And I'll get into that. But I want to know, do you feel that the way we gravitate to our leadership structure in our community is efficient? Do you feel like, you know, because we kind of take one person and look, this is our leader. Or do you feel like should be more of a unified effort as opposed to a singular effort that people invest into? Because it seems to me that we put a lot into one person and then we just like, oh, go ahead and do it.
Go ahead and rock out. I think that is a model that has proven to be ineffective. I think that it may have worked in a period of time, but I think that history has proven that, you know, the true change is going to happen when everybody rises up, everybody's gathered together. And I don't mean everybody is in like the whole city, just a critical mass.
Right.
You know what I mean? You don't really need everybody because everybody coming to the table sometimes can hurt the process.
Yes.
Right. I think the model of having one person sort of lead and direct the agenda, I'm not even sure how true that was back then, to be honest. Because, you know, even Malcolm had people that he counseled with. Mm-hmm. You know, same with Martin, same with several of the so-called messiah leaders, you know, the Fred Hamptons of the world and others. But I do understand how people look at that and perhaps lean on that as a vision because they were so iconic and are so iconic.
Right.
We can't get stuck in time. I think for 2021, I think what works best is particularly a city like Philadelphia. Because see, we're in a city of neighborhoods, right? Mm-hmm. So people in Southwest don't want necessarily Gabe to come in if I'm from Southwest. They want to know who they want somebody that they can trust. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Somebody from down the block. Okay, you was born down Greenway or Baltimore Ave,
right,
or
right.
King Sessing, or you know what I mean? Like Woodland Avenue. Like you understand the shops, the neighborhoods. You know, I mean, I might be able to make connections, right?
Yeah.
And I have, but I think ultimately people want, you know, to see somebody that they trust, a welcoming face, a familiar face. Mm. Maybe I had an uncle that went to Bartram, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff. And so I just say all that to say, it's going to take maximum effort from all of us to do a little bit more. And I'm not saying a whole lot more, but just a little bit more. And for folks who aren't doing, they got to start doing.
Right.
I mean, I can't say it any plainer than that. You know, I think about you, Elwin, and the work that you're doing in your, you know, daughter's school, in the community, even with this platform as an opportunity to have these courageous and brave conversations. Like, that's part of the work to get us to a different place. And I feel like there's too many of us, I think, who are comfortable waiting on somebody mm-hmm. else to step in and do the work, as opposed to saying, you know what? I actually have my own gifts, skills, and talents that can contribute to whatever change we want to see in the world.
That's Absolutely. Great. And that also reminds me of, you know, something you said in your film, We Breathe, We Live, Brotherly Love, mm-hmm. Protest Stories. You said, you know, moving from a space of love towards finding these solutions that we all need.
That's right.
Kevin Aliem echoed that with that component of spirituality and love is what we're going to do to get people through.
That's right. Yeah, brother. You know, that's the piece, man. We underestimate what it means to move from the space of love. Like with love as the central dynamic that moves the work. Mm. You know, love meaning like as in love is a verb, right? Love is an action term. You know, love allows us to behave in certain types of ways. And,
Absolutely.
You know, when Kevin so powerfully says, move us through, what he's saying is, you know, having that spirit when you wake up in the morning, having that spirit when you go to bed at night, and having that spirit throughout your day, like having that spirit of love and taking it with you throughout your routine. So, yeah, hopefully we'll be able to be guided by that as we move forward.
And another thing I really liked with Sunny Singh, the filmmaker and mm-hmm. digital archivist who was in the film, I liked what he was saying about ancestral obligation.
Mm.
I wonder if you connect to the idea of ancestral obligation.
Yeah, I do. Funny story about that we haven't shared much. He actually got that from a rally that I was speaking on. He wanted to say me, but I said, bro, like, you don't have to say that you saw Gabe. So I said, say that you were at a rally and you heard it. I've spoken often about that term because I think for me, you know, we're all ancestors in progress, which means like if we understand the power of who came before us to understand who we are today, you know, we're standing on their shoulders. You know, they left a legacy for us that is powerful and really is sacred. Like we should take it with a sense of respect, of honor, that those that came before us had the imagination that said, you know what, my great, great grand, you know what I mean? My great, great, great grand, my great grand, my grand is going to experience a life better than I did. And I'm going to work my hardest to make sure that they can live in a way that I can only imagine right now in my mind because it's the 20s or it's the 30s or it's the 60s or it's the 80s or wherever it was in that time period that our ancestors lived in a different kind of way, in a different kind of experience. We bear though that weight and that burden, frankly, and it's an obligation because it allows us to say, I am, by virtue of my lineage, connected to this people and their work. So whatever they did to lead us through, I'm now a part of that continuum. Mm. And so that's part of that obligation that was so powerful. And I thank Sunny for bringing it up. I think it was a real pivotal part of his story and his experience, which I think other folks can also understand as well.
I thought there was a really interesting choice in the film that I wonder if you could just talk about briefly.
Sure.
Or, you know, how you feel. So people are answering questions, but the questions are off air, right? So the questions are asked, but the viewer doesn't see them. And then the person is responding to that question. I really like that technique. I don't know where that came from or how you kind of came about that.
Yeah. So, you know, for the most part, and I want to thank our story coaches, you know, they worked with each of the guys to kind of frame out what they sort of wanted to say. But then on set, it's like you guys know, as the experts in this field, as things are kind of coming up, you know, as a producer on the film and some of my other colleagues on the film and my team, certain things that they said, you'd want to pull out, you know, more, right? Mm-hmm. So speaking, for instance, to, you know, Brother Greg, who runs the Malcolm X Park You know, there were certain things that he said that we said, wow, like, I want to pull out a bit more. When you said that they came to the park to hold an event and they had their event, and how was that for you? And how was it when the committee asked you, should they keep coming? Like, we were able to pull that from him only based on what he said earlier, and it just kind of stood out, right? Mm-hmm. So it kind of like on set. And so what it does is it provides for us like a nice organic conversation, allows us to kind of dig deeper. And I think it made all the stories that much more powerful and that much more rich, because we got a chance to expound more on what they already said. Even to your point about Sonny, you know, Sonny's somebody who has become sort of like the movement documentarian. You know, every action or rally we see in the city of Philadelphia, he's there with his camera. And, you know, him being able to talk about when the canister hit him, and that changed his whole perspective. Like, that's this powerful stuff that happens in communication. It's a great part to have, and a great strategy to have and technique to have, to kind of pull out some of those intimate details that may not have been a part of the original project.
You know, the film, when I watched it, it just made me reflect on like everything that happened in 2020, like sitting back and you watch it and you're saying to yourself, well, damn, if all of this stuff didn't happen, none of these good brothers that were telling their stories were actually, because they were at the same time, they were also tapping into their actual artistic ability too. They're also tapping into their voice. And you see a lot of them becoming more empowered, even with the young brother, Christopher.
Oh, yeah.
You see in real time, these guys tapping into their ability. You as well, with this this wonderful piece. Us as well, we were impacted by it too, and it forced us to get into a creative space, right?
That's right.
So you see all these things, and I thought that the film just did a beautiful job of connecting all of these things, getting the stories from these men, but also allowing people to see through despair. Obviously, there has to be somewhere to go, and that's up, right? You just don't stay in despair. And when you see when everything is around, when people are not going to work, when people are home, when people are forced to be in these spaces, what happens when things are stripped away? Yes, there's other stuff that's bad going on, but you're forced to be in a space of, what do I do? And that's where I find that the film kind of provoked you to see the despair, but also provoked you to see the beauty as well.
Yeah, and I think that's really well said. And I thought Christopher did a really great job of like really bringing the theme to bear of intergenerational struggle when he told that story about his grandmother who went up to Rizzo and told him she didn't vote for him. She knew he's a racist, but since he was elected mayor, they needed to talk.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the courage of that.
That's
moment.
That old time grandma working, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know? Right. Like you can almost like picture it in your head.
I didn't want you, where you are, but now that you're there, we got to talk.
Yep.
We got to have a conversation, right?
These are the things that's missing, because you see this brother in the street and he's like, feels it, but you can tell he's connected to what he's saying. Like, he's a powerful dude. And I was moved by, there's a couple things that's on my mind. No, but I was moved by when he said that he went to South Philly and he brought up in the middle of these white people that were like, you know, in their element and, you know, and being enraged because they were taking down the statue. Now, he's the Christopher Columbus statue. He was saying that, listen, I just wanted to say my piece and say what my thoughts were about it. But it's like they didn't want to hear it.
Nope.
And what I and this is the curveball, because for me, I feel like this is something that's been happening to, as black people, we come in humble ways. And it's like, you know, no, that's not going to work. We don't want to hear what you got to say. You don't, you're not worthy. You're not going to hear anything.
Right. And the guy saying that's wearing a t-shirt that says, I stand with Frank, who was just the guy that his grandma marched up to and told off.
Isn't that deep?
And you see what I'm saying?
We need to talk.
So there, it's like, it's saying, I don't want to hear shit you got to say. But the thing about it is, what made me think about this shit a little bit more deeply is, maybe we are taking what has happened to us in our culture that has been pushed on us.
Here we go.
And then we take that and we do it to each other. So it's like we're taking the fact that our voices are never heard, right? Because they're always suppressed. It's like he's just
Saying with these shootings.
I'm saying with this brother going up to the middle of a bunch of racist white people and trying to have his opinion heard, and nobody wants to. It's like, no, they, it's just, nobody wants to hear that shit. Right. So they just want to take him out. Mm-hmm. They don't know who he's connected to. He's an educator. He's saying, like, listen, I could be educating your damn kids.
He's a math educator. Exactly. I love his hip-hop math stuff.
Right? Yeah. I could be educating your kids.
Your children,
but
right.
at the same time, they don't want to hear it. Like, he's canceled out. And what I'm saying is this has been happening for centuries, right? What I'm saying is I feel like in our community, right, Gabe, I feel like this is what we've taken and adopted, and I feel like we do it to each other. Like, we take this cancel culture and say, that was the curveball I'm talking about. Because I'm saying that I got that from that. I'm saying to myself, well, damn. You know, it's probably because we're witnessing and we're absorbing it. It's like, no, we got to, you know, if you're not saying what I feel, we cancel each other out. That's an issue that I feel like is pervasive in our culture. But I feel like it has a place of origin as well.
Yeah, I definitely feel like, you know, sadly enough, too many conversations. And, you know, Elwin, you know, you and I have a lot of conversations.
Yes.
And sadly, there used to be a time where you could say something that you didn't agree with somebody, but you didn't want to cut them off. Like, that didn't mean that you could no longer talk to them again.
Exactly.
Or, you know, they were disposable. But I also think that, you know, the power of Chris's story also was the idea that, you know, his journey to quote unquote activism was so like by accident. You know, he went to get some pizza.
Right.
And they just went, you know, and he just happened to see the march. And as a teacher, saw young people and wanted to help young people and wound up being, you know, in this rally and in this march and ultimately leading the march.
That's right.
And now here he is in this moment that is ultimately transforms his entire life and probably his, you know, everything about it. So I just love those moments, man, because, you know, everybody can probably point out those moments or experiences in their own life. I said, that was when everything changed, right?
Right.
Or these couple things was when everything changed. That moment, and I knew that I would be different forever.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like that was the moment when he connected with his ancestral obligation.
There you go.
Just like
there
Sonny Singh did when he got hit in the neck with a tear gas
canister.
That's right.
Exactly.
Like, I go back to it. Their voices, it seems like they found their voices, and it's like they stand firm in it. And it's like now moving forward, this is what it is.
Yep.
This is an imprint on you. I wonder, you know, what has been the impact on you by creating this piece and being like, it's a culmination, because you're always on ground zero. Every day you're on ground zero. We have conversations with people, and I feel like the people we have conversations with in their own right are heroes. And that's why I feel that way about you. You're on ground zero every day, right?
Yeah.
So you see it every single day. What is the impact from then till now? What is the biggest impact in coming up with this film to what is the impact that this has had on you?
Well, first of all, I've become a better communicator, such as in me having to text you like, big bro, can I have a little extra time? Because I got pulled into this other thing.
Right.
And, you know, I still want to do it. I'm with y'all. But I've had to be a much better communicator. And I've also had to figure out ways to, you know, cope with my own wellness and health and find things that can kind of calm me down and be still.
Mm.
Because if not, my mind will be going in a million different ways. You know, I've been to more vigils than I care to go to, Elle and Zach. But it's just a part of the work, right? But you go to these things and it's always the same vision, man. It's like, I'll see, you know, usually a mom or grandma, but, you know, this fathers and parents as well, all there. And, you know, 3, 6, 10, 29 is there. And they got the chairs in the middle of the block. They got the whole street cut off. You know, they got some comments to the press. They released their balloons. Then they got food out and people talking. People, you know, elected officials make their comments. And while the whole thing's happening, there's always around the periphery of the group, a whole bunch of young men. Every single time, there's always a whole bunch of young brothers. Some of them on a bike. Some of them just standing there, you know, they look crestfallen, you know, they look blank faced. They're probably dealing with anger. Some of them probably want to retaliate. Some of them probably are just totally pissed off because that was their cousin. That was their old head. Mm. That was their young boy. That was their little cousin. That was at the boy on the block. So they knew. But as men, we're not often socialized on how to deal with that grief and loss and anger.
Mm.
And so what happens is without the right approach, they'll just leave from that and have all that undealt with aggression or pain. And so what I began doing several years ago was I always go to them brothers first. I'm trying to tell you, everywhere I go, it's always the same story. I go to those brothers first just to say, hey, man, I see you, man. I give him my card. I give him my number. And I'll be like, yo, man, if you ever need any, you know, tell me about something. This is me. You know, that number is my personal number. You know what I'm saying? Not the office number. That's my personal math. And if you need anything, just holler at me. They may not call me the next day. They may not ever call me. They may not call me the next week. But there have been multiple times, Ellen and Zach, where I've gotten a call like a month later out the blue. Like, yo, Mr. Bryant, you gave me your card like last summer or like last month.
Wow.
You know, I'm still dealing with the situation. You know, my old lady telling me it's that in the third. I need somebody to talk to, man, or I'm going to lose it. Like, it's happened every time. There's always at least one person out of all the cards I give out. That's why I do it, because I know that I'm bringing that home myself as a person trying to solve the issue or support the community. I can only imagine with those folks who have, you know, deeper ties to those who we've lost are dealing with. So I try to always be vigilant, man, but also provide some boundaries for myself as well. So, you know, once I feel like I'm done for the day, like after we're done here, I'm going to get a
down.
Meal.
Yeah.
I'm going to shut it down.
I'm going
to get a meal.
So, yes, right.
I'm just chill. I'm going to find some, so, you know, Luke Vandross. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Nice.
It just chill for the rest
and
of the night.
And take care of yourself.
Cool. Right. So thinking about how those young men, you know, on the sides of the vigils with their emotions all bottled up, you know, reminds me of a powerful moment in the film. You say that, you know, a lot of the time you keep your emotions bottled up. And I thought one of the things that the film did really, really nicely was with this part with Isaac Scott, where he talked about this cipher of hip hop dancers coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, you know, he showed the hip hop dancers and the footage of that. And he said, a beautiful moment of black joy in the face of everything that was happening. Make sure we're focusing on joy and love and community. So it really, you know, like brings things full circle.
Shout out to Isaac, man. And you know, he's the amazing photographer. Again, you know, people have asked me a lot, you know, Gabe, how did y'all find these folks? And my whole thing has always been, if you're rooted in community, you ain't got to go searching.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know what I mean? Yep. Like, you know what I mean? Yep. Like I knew, like I saw Isaac last summer. You know what I mean? Like I saw him, Malcolm X Park, downtown, City Hall. He'd be running around on his bike, taking pictures. I'm like, who's this guy taking all these pictures? Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, you know, it was amazing stuff. You know, I saw, you know, Mr. Greg and Malcolm X Park, right? Like Aaron, I saw the whole Watawala situation. So, you know, the interesting thing about this was it allowed all the men to be vulnerable. Even myself, to your point about me thinking about it on those art museum steps, like it was very emotional for me to even think back to 2020 and all the things that I was thinking about, seeing thousands upon thousands of people from the art museum
that
or down the parkway.
Lying down for 8 minutes, 46 seconds.
Man. Yeah.
That was crazy. That was some.
Like what?
Yes, that footage. That was just like, man. Like rewatching that, I was like, shit. That was fucking amazing. It's
so
like
powerful.
It's amazing, man.
It has to be. Like that's what I'm saying. The impact of that, to see all of those people. Like that's the thing. To see all of those people coming together on that on one accord like that. Like that. The impact of that has to be like overwhelming. Has to be.
And that's why I really appreciated the sentiment from Ishmael. It's just like, look, man, I'm asked to speak, but you didn't know it was going to be that many people. Like you get there and it's like, whoa, I didn't know it was going to be like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, you're there. It's like, wait a minute, this is a whole different ball game.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And so I really appreciated what he had to say as far as like, look, man, but once you're in that moment, now you're thinking about, all right, this is going to go down in history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what do I say? Who do I want to bring in? Again, ancestors, again, obligation. He's thinking about Fred Hampton and Malcolm and Marcus Garvey. He's trying to figure out who can I channel, you know, inside of me to make sure that whatever I say hopefully can resonate with at least one person of the thousands who were there.
Right.
You know,
right.
So yeah, powerful stuff, man.
Mm-hmm. A memorable part of Isaac Scott's story, too, was talking about what happened on 676 with the protests and the tear gas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that was, and you saw that on his face. You saw that emotion on his face.
Yes,
you know?
And he got
says,
teared up.
You know, it's going to leave a mark. You know, again, people don't understand, man, or rather, maybe they do understand, but don't really fully grasp it. Like these issues of civil unrest, of protest, of rallying, fighting for change, you know, fighting for liberation, for our freedoms. Like it is a very heavy and emotionally heavy experience, man. Even for those who are the fighters, you know what I mean? It's very heavy, man. I mean, you're dealing with a lot of pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And again, to experience that is just deep. you know, and we can't discount how much of that weight can kind of wear on you to see situations like that. You know what I mean? So I appreciated his vulnerability in that moment and him being willing to share that moment with us, because I think that it really captured what not only he was experiencing, but a whole lot of folks were experiencing as well. But now perhaps haven't had a chance to express it themselves.
Right.
Publicly.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about your work with MOVE. And I would love, because I don't think there's anybody else that would be able to give a clear understanding of what MOVE stood for and stands for, and what they have been through and are going through now.
Sure.
Because I know there's not a very clear understanding of their purpose to a lot of people in the city, sure. But I know that you do solid ground zero work with them. And I would love to hear past, present, but just your experience and your personalized experience with them.
Yeah, I first met Ramona Africa, who was one of two survivors and currently the only living survivor of the 1985 MOVE bombing. I met her for the first time actually in college, undergrad at Penn State, Elwin. This was the fall semester of 99, the Black Caucus had brought her up to speak. And so this is, you know, 22 years ago. And I just remember like the entire, you know, auditorium, I think it was in Heritage Hall, I believe, in the hub. And I just remember how powerful it was. And at the time, you know, me being born and raised in New York, although I've been coming to Philadelphia since I was a kid, because I have family, I have, you know, my grandma, uncles, aunts, uncle with the Gratz, you know, my aunt with the Pierce. I got family that went to Washington. I've been coming to Philly since I was like 7 years old because I have family here. But I'm, you know, in New York. So, but I didn't know about the MOVE bombing. And so to hear it in 99, this whole story about what happened at that time, 14 years later, I'm like, what? And it blew my mind that any city, like I heard about Tulsa, you know what I mean? What they did in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But I hadn't heard anything like this vicious since then, as far as like in modern times.
Right.
And so it just blew my mind. And so I said, look, once I graduate, you know, if I wound up in Philly, I'm going to connect with y'all and see how I can help. Particularly also because at the time, members of the MOVE 9 had did about 21 years of prison from a standoff in 1978. And it's so amazing because, you know, I come to Philadelphia August 2001. I'm literally at my first rally for Mumia MOVE within 8 weeks. It was literally like right after 9/11. I remember it like it was yesterday. And so since that time period, I've been working to support, you know, many of the people who have been incarcerated through MOVE, as well as Mumia MOVE Jamal. MOVE is actually coming up on 50 years next year. It started in 1972. The founder, John Africa. Their whole philosophy is life. Mm. They believe in life, period. Life of humans, animals, and the environment. Mm. You know, what's little known about MOVE is that at the same time that they would protest around police violence, they protest at the zoo.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like the majority of the protests were actually at the zoo at the time, like in the 70s, because they were like, yo,
animal rights.
Why are you bringing these animals?
Right.
You know what I mean? To be in these cages. Like that's a lion. Wow. Like that's a whole tiger that you put in a 6x8. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so they would go to like the pet coves and things of that nature at the time, of course, and be like, no, like we shouldn't be doing this. Animals should be free because it's about life. They were heavy about, you know, raw food and eating raw foods. You know, they believed in, again, life, you know, clean air. And so that was really a big part of their work. You know, a lot of the elders will tell you that. And that continued even into the 80s. And so when they had the standoff in 78 and ultimately the bombing in 85, you know, the powerful thing about it is that, like, I've met neighbors who were there in 78 in Powhatan Village and 85 Osage Avenue who knew them. Now, of course, not everything was cordial, right? Everybody wasn't 100 with them. But I did meet neighbors who were like, yo, like, regardless of what I thought about what they were doing, none of them deserved to have their home bombed and to start a blaze that would burn 61 homes and displace over 250 people.
Absolutely.
Like that was, regardless of how I feel about MOVE, I'm talking about other people saying this, like I might not have been down with them politically, but it's not like they were hurting the community.
Absolutely.
And nor were they trying, and nor did they deserve that.
No. You know?
So that's one thing that I think everybody can be clear on.
Right. Absolutely. Wow.
And also, too, what is the current status of Mumia Abu-Jamal?
So the good thing is that when you work in this work for as long as I have, you have these victories, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so 3 years ago, after, again, years of protests, rallies, calling the governor, I'm talking about going back to Governor Ridge, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Working with the DAs, going back to Lynn Abraham. I'm talking about years, Nutter administration, Randell, visiting DA's offices, writing, making, petitions. But in 2018, after 40 years, we were able to get Debbie Africa and Mike Africa Sr. home, the Move 9, who were the parents of Mike Africa Jr. 2019, we got home Eddie Africa, Janine Africa, Janet Africa, all the Move 9 now. Then 2020, we got home Chuck Africa and Delbert Africa, sadly just passed last year as well, after 6 months out. So they were all out. And so now our whole goal is, okay, since they're all out, based on the reasons that we have legally, then the person who's left is Mumia Abu-Jamal, who's now been incarcerated since 81. He'll be coming up for 40 years in December. And there's so much, legal and factual evidence that shows that he did not do what they said that he's done. And he's been declaring his innocence since December of 81. I visited Paris, France, and they got a whole city. They got a whole street named after Mumia Abu-Jamal. You know what I mean? I saw my own eyes. I'm talking to the mayor, while I'm in Paris, and she's saying, Mumia Abu-Jamal, he's one of our sons. You know what I mean? As far as the work that he was doing, because of the impact that he's made. And that's across the water, right? In Europe. Of the dozen books that Mumia has written, Mumia is staying strong. I can tell you that essentially right now he's had some health issues. He had COVID-19. He has had, diabetic shock several years ago. He was dealing with diabetes, all kinds of other health ailments. Recently, he had congestive heart disease. And so he's been dealing with a lot. And sadly, Zach and Elwin, many of our prisons sadly have become almost like senior homes. It's a whole bunch of elders in these prisons across the country of folks who are 60 plus, who have had to deal with decades of bad food, bad water, no sunlight, just poor everything. Right. You know what I mean? Just overall poor conditions. And now they're up in age. So like I said, like Delbert Africa, he could come out after 42 years, but he passes away within 6 months because of his physical ailments. So we're trying to move to get Mumia Abu-Jamal out. That's always been the campaign, free him all, free Mumia Abu-Jamal. But while he's in there, he continues to write, stay strong. People can go to prisonradio.org, and every couple of weeks provides a new commentary on what's going on in the ways of the world. That's pretty much what we've been doing.
Thanks for sharing, giving a clear and concise picture of the history of these beautiful people. I grew up in this city. I always knew about Move, but I just never understood, right? And I think that it's important for us to understand, the significance of this group of people and what they stood for, because we just tie them into violence that winds up being their story, and it's completely the opposite, right?
Yeah.
They're completely peaceful people in the communities. People were, appeared to be disconnected. But it's it's not okay for us to just go by without shedding a bright light on people who have stood for things that they were standing for people and for life in general.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. The thing about Move was that they were just ahead of their time. That's the whole piece, right?
Absolutely.
They had locks way before locks was really out. So, a lot of people that really had locks was the Rosses.
Yep.
Bob Marley was just coming out.
Yep.
But the average brother or sister in the neighborhood wasn't wearing locks.
Yep.
Didn't know what that meant. Now you can't watch an NFL game without everybody having locks underneath their helmet. Right. You know what I mean? They ate raw foods. Bruh.
Everything is raw food.
Everything's raw food. Yep. Everything's Whole Foods. Everything's Trader Joe's. Yep. Everything's healthy eating. They took their kids. They homeschooled their children.
Yep.
Bruh.
Animal
is
rights.
That not the biggest? Is that not the biggest thing right now for parents and guardians? Is to homeschool children and have cyber schools and opportunities that are not in the school system, right?
Absolutely.
Because we don't want that, right? As the only option. I mean, they understood fitness for themselves. And the women and girls, stayed in shape, stayed fit. So there's a lot of things that might have been, perhaps odd or strange to folks back then, but are, frankly, if we're honest, commonplace now when you think about it in a totality, right? Home births. They didn't want to take the women who were having children to hospitals, so they had the children in the house.
Right.
Bro, there's a whole birthing centers right now with doulas and midwives who are doing the things across the country who don't choose to have the children in hospitals. I mean, that's a big industry across the country. So, again, man, a lot of the things that they were doing were just, I think, ahead of the time. And people had to catch up to it.
Right.
So
in your journey of service, for the betterment of Black people, what has been your most challenging and disheartening experience or experiences, and as well as what has been the most gratifying and promising?
It's a great question. Well, first, let me say that back on the move thing, you know, one of the challenges has been that there's been a lot of elders who have passed on. Recently, Kunspilla Africa just passed on. May she rest in peace. They just identified the move remains that are being held at Penn and Princeton. So they're still dealing with the closure of that. So there's a lot of pain involved still with these ongoing stories. But if I had to think about overall what has been some of the challenges, one thing that comes to mind is our ability to understand that, you know, we have to unite, even if it's just some of us. You know, there's a lot of things that we've held on to, you know, generational issues, the traumas we've had to face, dealing with the, you know, the couplet of racism, white supremacy, anti-blackness, along with, you know, just trying to deal with families and standing strong. It's a lot. And so I understand why people make the choice to say, you know what, as Morpheus said, the red pill and the blue pill. I understand why folks say, you know what, I think I'm going to just have this ignorance is bliss and I don't want to deal with it. Like, I get it, because people's everyday experience is already so challenging. To walk that road, to have that burden as a Neo is tough, because you know what it's hitting for. And you know that once you know more, you got to do more. And so, I mean, for me, it's been about always trying to figure out new ways to bring new folks into the fold and not get stuck with old ideas that may not be effective in the current time.
Right.
You know, we can't keep doing the same things over and over and over again, expecting a good response or, you know, things to change. You know, we got to try new things, and we got to be in better communication with the young folks who have a whole, their own level of new ideas as they come to the table. Right. Because youth are always the spark for evolution. But I think the victories that I've seen, or some of the good things I've seen, is our ability to, I think, keep the movement intergenerational. You know what I mean? I mean, I know I can only speak for myself. People that know me know that I have a lot of great relationships with young people, you know, people who are teenagers and in their 20s, and also people who are like in their 70s and like late 60s. I just love both groups of people, because I learn so much from each group. And I'm kind of always gaining so much insight, wisdom about how to move this thing. The elders, because they got so many rich stories of, you know, being down Columbia Avenue during the riot of 64, or what they did to bring about Girard College, to bring it, you know what I mean? I mean, there's so much rich history that I love to just soak up. And it gives me food and it nurtures me to just be like, you know what? If they could do that back then, I know I could do what I'm doing now. And then to see the young people who just are vibrant, and they're using social media in a whole new way. And they all got, you know, podcasts, and they all got writing, and they're all making music, and they all got videos and using Instagram and Twitch and everything else. I'm inspired by their ingenuity with regards to like technology and how they're using technology to advance the movement. That's what kind of, you know, helps me out, at least, is that. And I'll close by saying this. We can't never discredit small victories. Like, that helps momentum. That keeps people hopeful. Mm-hmm. That adds that joy of like the work, right? And you gotta make the work joyful, right? The work is the work. It's hard, it's difficult at times, but there's ways to make the work, you know, give it its fun moments as well. And we always try to make space and make time to make the work fun as well. Shout out to the folks with BLM Philly. They started what's called a Jaunteeth event, you know. So we got to, so that's Jaunteeth.
Jaunteeth.
Got to keep it, you know, got to call it Philly.
Yep.
But it's an opportunity for everybody to come together. And it's just, it's so much positive energy. And it's a way for us to just relax, let our hair down, you know what I mean? Hear some speakers about Juneteenth, but also see some dope performances on the stage and some dope spoken word artists and MCs. And, you know, so that kind of, those days are important to, like, again, keeping our spirits alive and keeping us going forward.
That's beautiful.
That's dope, man. And, you know, listen, I'm always excited to talk to you, like, all the time. Like,
we talk all the time, brother.
You know what I mean? We talk all the time. And
yes, sir.
It's always level set conversations that I have with you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's always conversations where, you know, and you let me go. You know what I mean? When I talk, you let me go, and I appreciate that. You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
Like I said, we've known each other for a long time. I always felt like an older, bigger brother, but now I feel like you the bigger brother.
You're my big bro.
No, because I appreciate you. I appreciate the work that you do, and I love you, man. And I want the best for you, and I know because you want the best for everybody else.
No question.
You know what I mean?
No
question. That's something that I know. You know what I mean? That's something that I know for sure. So I wanted this to be a platform for you to be able to, for people to see you in a light and see the person that you really are.
Thank you. And I really, again, I'll say this, man, Penn State and knowing you and Reggie and Larry, you know what I mean?
Yep. Yep.
Like that was like, y'all were like our, you know what I mean? Like we just looked up to y'all. I mean, that's just a fact. Like we did, you know what I mean? Shout out to my crew, Jamar and Juice and you know what I mean? Everybody. But, you have remained to be you and your sister, actually, you know, y'all just stars, man, like rock stars to me. And still to this day, because I think that what I've always appreciated about you, L, is that nobody could ever say that Elwin is not going to give it to you straight. Like, Elwin is going to make sure that you hear what he's saying. You know what he's saying. You're going to feel his passion. You're going to feel his energy.
Absolutely.
1,000,000%.
Absolutely.
And so, so I appreciate that about you. And Zach, man, like I said, I've been listening to the podcast, and I'm definitely interested in seeing how you develop. And thank you
thank you so much for
being
joining
a part
us.
Of this, man.
Yep.
Yeah, because what y'all are doing, again, having this talk, talking, mm-hmm. just the concept of this, of y'all talking. I mean, right now, in the moment of time, more than ever before, we need this right here.
True.
Thank y'all for doing this.
Thank you. And I just want to say, We Breathe, We Live, Brotherly Love, Protest yes. Stories is available on PBS and WHYY.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
Well, yeah, man. Thanks again, brother. Thanks again. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And, like I said, I always enjoy your conversation. And please, man, stay 10 toes down like you do, and take care of yourself.
Yeah. Thanks
so
much.
I'm going to try. If anybody wants to holler at me, Gabriel Bryan on Facebook, Good Brother Gabe on Instagram. Have a good one, y'all.
You too, man.
Right, take care now.
Peace.
As a disclaimer, Zach and I don't pretend to speak for all white or all black people.